Well, as I mentioned, we took a little vacation right after the conference, and we went to Virginia to see our daughter and son-in-law and three grandchildren. And on Memorial Day weekend, we took our three grandkids camping in West Virginia. And we found there, I'm sure, the same thing that all of the children and staff discovered at Camp Lone Star this past week as they were there, and that is that it's really good at times to unplug. It's good to get away from the world. No cell phones, no laptops, no TVs, no radios. Our entertainment of course, that's not too hard to do in West Virginia. You know, we were only about 25 miles from Winchester, Virginia, but none of those services were available. Phones were dead, everything. You were just cut off. Our entertainment at night was sitting around the fire and telling stories and roasting marshmallows. Things like that. And it's good. Humans need to do that. There is something about being outside, being in nature, that God created that is good for us. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later as to maybe why. But it has a subtle and maybe sometimes not so subtle effect on us humans, especially when we are attuned to God. It's good for all of humans to do this. But for those who are attuned to God, there is something even more profound that takes place. There are many scriptural references to nature. It is often used in the Psalms. The psalmist often connected nature to God, to his power, using things in his creation to serve as similes and metaphors and analogies, sometimes about God himself. How many times do you read about God being our rock? Well, you know, he's not a rock. But as soon as you hear that, God is our rock, we connect that to something that reminds us of the spiritual meaning from that description. Think about the hymns we sing. We sing, "To the hills I'll lift mine eyes. Ah, from whence shall come my help? All my help comes from the Lord who has made the heaven and earth." It is a reminder. Our help comes from God. And why is he powerful? Because he made this. Look at the heaven. Look at the earth. It is a reminder of his power. We sing the song titled, "Praise Ye the Lord." And a large portion of those songs, verses, are talking about things in the world around us that we see in nature. We even find songs relating us humans to nature. Psalm 1, one of our most familiar songs, says, "Blessed and happy is the man," and it says, "he will be like a tree that grows by the riverside." Well, what does that mean? A human being will be like a tree. Well, that's a song we sing, but we're supposed to take that and think about what it means. What is the analogy of a tree that grows by the riverside to a human that follows God? There are great lessons in that. We sing the song, "How excellent in all the earth." And it has that phrase, "When I look up into the heavens, which thine own fingers frame, to the moon and to the stars, which were by thee ordained." What is that telling us to do? Look at what God made. And then you reach a question, what is man? As we sing, what is man that you should be mindful of him? Look at the world that God created and think about it. Then there's my personal favorite psalm, Psalm 19. And it starts out, "The heavens God's glory do declare, the skies his handiworks teach." I'm going to use that psalm today, and I hope we will be taught some things out of that, but I'm going to use that psalm to reflect on some really important lessons of life. But first, I want to set a stage for that before we go there. And you can go there, and that's the only place we'll be today. So you can, you don't have to mark it that we're going to go nowhere else but there. But before we open up to those verses, I want to tell you, in order to set the stage for this, about something absolutely fascinating that I learned a few years ago about the heavens and nature. And it's just another marvel about God's creation. I was listening to this on the way into work one morning on NPR's Morning Edition. The scriptures talk about looking into the heavens, and so did the introduction to this report. It was fascinating, so I went online and got the transcript of it. But I'll summarize without reading through this interview because several people were interviewed. But the reporter began by saying, "Step outside on a clear day this summer and look up. What do you see? Blue, maybe a bird or a plane up there, but otherwise nothing. Or so you think. It turns out that right above you, totally invisible, is an enormous herd of animal life." Then he went on to interview a man named Dr. Matt Greenstone, who's an entomologist, somebody who studies insects. And he said years ago, on a fall afternoon, he was riding his bike, and all of a sudden, little black specks started falling out of the sky all over him. He said it looked like a black rain was coming down. And he said there must have been millions of these. And then he realized on looking closer, they were alive. And he said, you could see that they had legs, eight of them. Okay, some of you get it. I see your faces. Because what has eight legs? Spiders. Spiders have eight legs. And he said they'd just fallen out of the sky. Well, he was a scientist, so he starts thinking about this scientifically, and he figures, well, what comes down must have gone up. But how in the world did they get up there? Well, the interviewer on this program then talked with another entomologist, May Barenbaum, who said that 90 years ago, people already knew that there were all kinds of bugs high off the ground, particularly when some of the early airplanes came back with aphids plastered all over the windshields. And what they discovered as they began looking at this is that this was not an accident, it's not a mistake, that these animals want to be carried aloft. They want to be carried off, and you can see them sometimes deliberately launching themselves into the air, especially when they can get some turbulent air just off the ground. They will climb up to a high point in their environment. Is that even if it's just a blade of grass, wherever they are, they will find the highest point. And he said some of them stand up on their little back legs, and just by doing that, they can get part of their body up into this layer where it's more turbulent, and then if they can catch a ride on a gust of wind, they get carried off the ground. It's like a sailplane that catches a thermal updraft, and up they go. They get carried aloft. He said, sometimes you can actually see them leaping to get these drafts of turbulent wind. He said the way that they discovered that a spider does it is that it has a silken thread. You know, we all know that spiders can make webs. And he said it can actually be several meters long at times. And he said when the spiders landed on him and his bicycle, he watched them crawl up to the highest point that they could. He said for some it might have been his finger or the bell on the bicycle handle. He said they stuck their little behinds up in the air, which is where the silk comes from. And if the silk that they started spinning got a little draft of air, off they would go, going back up again. Question is, why? Why would they do this? Well, they discovered that insects sometimes need to leave where they are to go someplace else for food, oftentimes for mating, but for whatever reasons there are, they disperse themselves. So he said, when you go out and look up at the clear blue sky and you see nothing up there but blue and clouds, it turns out, though, that you're under a vast, teeming highway of animals that are there, but they are invisible to you. They have found ladybugs at 6,000 feet, really tiny little mites at that elevation, parasitic flies, tiny little wasps, cucumber beetles at 3,000 feet, lots of aphids, scorpion flies at 5,000 feet, little fruit flies at 3,000 feet, thrips, micro wasps, scale insects, a lot of insects. The all-time altitude champion was a single male termite that they found at 19,000 feet up in the air. He said, you wonder how these little critters can survive the turbulence and the cold and the absence of just company. But he said, they are very tough. In one study, They captured 1,610 insects in the air, and 97% of them were alive and undamaged. Just up there, carried aloft. But that's not all. They started then trying to calculate how many are there on a typical summer day. The way they did that, he said, what they do to count bugs, the scientist will imagine or define a column of air going way up into the sky, and then they will measure how many insects pass through that column in a month. There was a recent study calculated by a radar device in Great Britain, and the scientist included that in 1 month, in a column of air 6/10 of a mile wide, in this column of air, there were 30 million large insects, the kind that can be detected on their radar, large ones. They estimated that for all of the insects, including the aphids and the little tiny creatures, it was around 3 billion that went through a 6/10 of a mile column of air over a month. And they further said that was in Great Britain. You go closer to the equator and the numbers rise. One scientist said he wouldn't be surprised if over the skies of Houston or New Orleans there could be 6 billion critters passing through the air overhead in a month. Now, they said that was surprising to them too, but they said there is so much going on over your heads right now that you have no idea and previously had no idea about. The name of this interview, the title of the interview was The Billion Bug Highway. The Billion Bug Highway. All you have to do is go on Google and put in Billion Bug Highway, and it will take you to an NPR video on it. It's really great to show little kids, but you'll find no matter what your age is, it's very interesting. And it shows in animation a lot of the things that I just told you. Well, I heard that. I thought, there it is. There's another example. How often are we learning new things? And you find out these things have always been there. We just didn't know it. We're the ones who are learning about the creation of what is going on around us and how amazing it is. You look, just look into the heavens, and everything about what God made is astounding. We are learning things that are so big about the galaxies that we can't comprehend it. And then we learn things that are so little about the bugs up there that it's almost hard to comprehend as well. And you realize that God gets you, going or coming, big or small, you know, He gets you amazed at everything that He has done. We're always discovering new things. For us, though, for us who believe in God, we put everything that we see in the context of what God is doing. The world doesn't do that necessarily. Many people don't. They leave it in the physical realm. They study the physical realm. And it's greatly interesting. But for us, discovering new things about the physical, we connect that to thinking about new things spiritually as well. And that's what Psalm 19 is all about. God made creation so complex. We as humans, if we go into a field of study or science, humans will isolate a very tiny part of creation. And there are scientists who make a lifelong study about a very small sliver of one area of specialty. They will study that their entire lives and it still find that it holds more to study than can be accomplished in their lifetime. David was not a specialist. David was a generalist. David was one of these men that it seems he just had a lot of interest about a lot of different things. And he was very interested. He wrote about it a lot. We know he was interested about things, but he was more of a generalist. He did understand a lot. We also know there were some very advanced concepts of astronomy, even back in his time, that things that they understood about. In Psalm 19, he chose to briefly describe some of his understanding about the heavens and how it ties into an even more complex and important, a more important field of study, and that is the law of God. The law of God. Let's see the way that David works through this. Beginning in verse 1 of Psalm 19, it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Now it says the heavens, plural. Back then, I wonder if somebody said, what do you mean the heavens? The heavens, plural. But today we do understand there are different levels of heavens. We have the immediate atmosphere, the clouds, the weather patterns, thunder and lightning storms, all of these things by themselves are incredible areas of scientific study. And they demonstrate incredible works of power. But then we also have the solar heavens, what the Bible in other places calls the firmament. It's beyond what we have in the atmosphere surrounding our earth. The marginal reference here, if you have a New King James, you might note the firmament shows his handiwork. The word firmament says the expanse of heaven. It's the expanding part of the universe. And then we have 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 2, which talks about the third heaven, meaning God's realm. But David makes a general statement here. The heavens declare the glory of God. In other words, the declaration of the heavens is continual. Now, David wrote this how many centuries ago? But if he were resurrected today and walked outside on his first night of life back, he would see the same stars, same planets, same moon that he saw back then. The heavens have continually been there. Every single moment of our lives, every single moment of all human history, they have been there, and they stand as a continual reminder of God's existence, God's power, God's glory, His wisdom, His law. They stand as a memorial and a reminder of His law. They declare the glory of God. And I suspect if David were resurrected today, and someday he will be, and he'll find out and be fascinated by what we have discovered since his time. We have discovered more that has revealed more about how the heavens and the firmaments work. We know a bit more now about the laws, if you will, that sort of hold it together. Why does it work this way? The laws of time and space and distance, how planets are regulated in their motion, the forces of gravitational attraction, and so on. But it's not just that anybody looks up into the heavens and is awed by that. I mean, even atheists look up into the heavens and they're awed by the beauty. But those who understand and those who have God in the picture realize they declare the glory of God. The heavens declare the glory of God. They argue for an intelligent, planned, law-giving, sustaining, controlling creator. There have to be questions about how did they come to be there? How do they work with such consistency, such dependability? Something put them there. Verse 2, day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. In other words, day after day, one day to another, forever. It's a continual testimony. And day after day utters speech. We keep discovering things that we didn't know before. The phrase utter speech means literally to pour forth. Pours forth. God's creation is continually teaching us. We're learning all the time. It's conveying things that we didn't know. I walked by my wife's computer last night. She had it up, and there was some strange-looking fish. And I said, wow, that's beautiful, isn't it? She goes, yeah, it's some new fish they discovered down in Australia. We never knew it existed. But we're learning things all the time. Night unto night shows knowledge. Knowledge about what? Well, it's not just knowledge about the universe. It is also knowledge about God. The stars have their courses. They're orderly. They are certain. It never wavers. One commentary says the original language here has in it the thought of pouring out or welling over with speech. So, you've probably known some people who just well over with speech. Well, he says the universe is like that. He says it's as though days and nights are like a flowing fountain. of thought and information for us to think about. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. You will notice the words "there is" and "where" are in italics. They were not in the original. Literally put, you would read verse 3, no speech, no words, their voice is not heard. No speech, no voice, their voice is not heard, no word. In other words, this is not a teaching that one hears. There are not awesome sounds. When you look up into the universe, you hear nothing. There is no humanly devised descriptive words. It is purely a visual lesson of observation. But what a powerful lesson. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. The word line in Hebrew means a cord or line, and it was often used in other places as a measuring line. It's a measuring line is what he's saying here. Now, verse 4, Psalm 19:4, there's a very interesting use of this verse in the New Testament. Somebody quoted this verse in the New Testament, and it's probably hard to think of, but Paul quoted this verse one time. I'll just make reference to it. In Romans 10, beginning in verse 15, Paul is saying, "How shall they preach except they be sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bring glad tidings of good things. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah said, Lord, who has believed our report? So then faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. But I say, have they not heard?" And then he quotes Psalms 19:4. "Yes, their sound went into all the earth, and their words unto the ends of the world." Paul quoted Psalm 19:4 in relation to the point he was making about preaching the gospel. Now, David's psalm is about the universe. And David's making the point that the universe stands as a testimony. It always has been here to the glory of God. Paul is putting it in the context of God's word, the gospel going out, and it has gone out. The gospel has been preached since the time of righteous Abel. It's been there. God has never left humanity without a witness to the gospel of peace. It's an interesting use that Paul said, I'm going to take that verse in Psalm 19:4 and apply it to the existence of the gospel going out. So we have four verses here. In them, to finish verse 4, he set a tabernacle for the sun. Now he changes. David changes direction a little bit, and he narrows it down from all the heavenly bodies now to the sun itself. And the sun, for us, is certainly the most dominant heavenly body that we have in our skies. It gives us light, gives us power. Take it away. If the sun ceased to exist right now, in about 8 minutes, we'll know all about it. Because we will cease to exist too. The sun has been set there. Life itself is dependent upon the sun. The sun, he said in verse 5, is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Every day, you can count on the sun's presence. Its rising is from one end of heaven, its circuit to the other. The word circuit here means a coming about or a return, like it is with the seasons, of a year. We don't sit here today and talk about our gardens and wonder if next year we'll have summer. We know. We know when the seasons will come. We never question whether or not they will. They always do. They always have, always will be predictable. Its rising is from one end of heaven and its circuit to the other end. And there is nothing hidden from its heat. The effect of the sun is everywhere. It is necessary for all things, for plant life, animal life, sea life, human life. Now, after talking about the sun for a couple of verses, David takes a very abrupt turn in this song. And at first, if you're just reading through, it's almost like, well, he jumps from one subject to another, and it's totally disjointed. You think there's no transition here, but not really. It's not really. Keep in mind, David was writing a poem. He was writing a song. So we're not expecting him to go into a lengthy discourse about his topic, about he's not trying to explain scientifically everything he knew about the sun and the heavens. He's writing it in the form of a song, a poem. But it is clear that as you think about the subject that he's introduced it with, the heavens and the sun, if you're going to meditate on the universe, if you're going to meditate on that part of creation, there would come a natural segue to the next part of your meditation. Sooner or later, you're going to be thinking about something, and that is the law. What keeps it all together? Humans have pondered that. Humans have understood. In fact, there are some very interesting articles and books written by some people who were former atheists who have come to the conclusion that due to the laws of probability and mathematics, it could not be an accident. Now, there are some of the rare people who've swung from being non-believers to being believers, at least believers in a God. But you have to ask the questions, and people have always asked the questions. How does it operate this way? So David moves to something that is very logical, really, to come to, and that is the law. It's natural for humans to ask why, how, and it's impossible to consider the whys and the hows of the universe without the subject of law coming up. And we have, along with our studies of science, we have come up with many identifications of various laws. Laws of that involve the world of physics. We have laws of mathematics. We even put names to them, so-and-so's law. And there are many of them. Those of you who have been into science, you will know this. Many laws. Why do we call it so-and-so's law, or this law, or that law, the law of gravity, the law of thermodynamics? Why do we call them those? It's because that's what they are. They are laws. They have the power of performance and rule. The universe works this way according to rules. Law is an explanation of why and how things work. Law is an explanation of why and how things work, how things are held together, if you will, why you can depend on the working of the universe, why you can depend on the great precision of what will happen and when it will happen far into the future. Even atheists, non-believers talk about there are laws that govern. They recognize that. The creation works according to law. And the laws, we know, that govern nature were given by God. And they have a profound effect. Law has a profound effect. Now, I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the sermon that I'd talk a little bit more about why there's something about being in nature that does it, why it's good for humans. I've actually begun seeing a little bit of some scientific study on this, and I think there's probably more to be done, but more will come out, the scientific connections of why nature is good for humans. But to put it in a non-scientific way, some years ago I was backpacking up in the Sierra Nevadas with a friend, and we'd been out for a couple of days logging a lot of miles, and we were just talking about how great it was to be out up in the mountains. And he said, have you ever thought about why it is when a person is stressed, whenever you're stressed, that if you go for a walk in the woods or a walk along the beach, or you just sit and look at a lake, or you watch the sun come up some morning and you just sit there and think, have you ever noticed how it has a calming effect? I said, yeah, I've noticed that. He said, have you ever asked why? And I said, well, probably not. You notice that it does that, but I don't know particularly why there's a sense of peace and tranquility that you get when you're out in nature. And he said, well, I have a theory. He said, I think it is because when you're in nature, you are in a lawful environment. You're in a lawful environment. In other words, when you're in nature, you're in an environment that God created. And everything in nature works according to law. Whether it's birth, death, decay, part of the food chain, plant or animal kingdom, whatever it is, everything works according to law. And where there is law, there is order. There's an orderliness to it. The seasons will come. Things will die, they'll decay, they go into the ground creates new life, it goes through a cycle. There's an order to it. It's interesting, we use a phrase a lot about law and order. You ever thought about why do we call it law and order? It's because when there is law, the law establishes an orderliness to life. An orderliness. And he said, when you're in nature, you're in a lawful environment. Now, you don't have to go out in that environment and think about it. It just happens to you. You go out in nature, you spend some time in God's creation, and it's calming. A lawful environment is a peaceful, orderly environment. What you see around you is predictable. It's predictable when you're in nature. And so there is a sense of steadiness when things are predictable. He said, why do we get away from people and cities? Because people and city life is unpredictable. It's unpredictable. Man-made environments are often unlawful. They are often unpredictable what's going on there, and therefore they are stressful. He said, you get into creation and you find peace. Now, a skeptic may say, well, that's a far-flung theory and it's totally unprovable scientifically. Maybe, but it makes sense to me. It makes sense. Law has a profound impact, and when things are lawful, you have a different environment. You have a totally different environment. So all of a sudden, David makes an abrupt turn in this song from describing nature to now he starts describing a condition between humans and God. It's a sudden turn in the subject. He didn't have to explain it, though, because I think when he was writing it under God's inspiration, it's as though he has an expectation that the reader will connect the dots. He doesn't have to tell us, okay, now I'm going to draw this parallel. No, we just connect the dots. We draw the right conclusion. Law governs nature. Now let's talk about how law governs us. He goes into, starting in verse 7. By the way, as an aside, the concepts we're going to look at are very deep. They require a lot of study. We're going to read them in just a handful of verses. But when you think about it, David had to invest a lot of thought into what he was going to write about here. The concept is deep, and that's the most important thing. But the way it is written, is also just brilliant. I have to spend a lot of time editing. Editing people's articles, things like that, that come through. From an editorial point of view, what follows in verses 7 through 9 is very beautifully and creatively constructed. It's a brilliant piece of writing. Because David begins describing the core issues of what governs life, human life. And he uses It's intriguing the way he does it. He uses six descriptive words. Six descriptive words: law, testimony, statutes, commandments, fear, and judgments. He uses six words to describe what he's talking about. And then, for each word, he notes two things: a characteristic quality and an effect. And in the space of three verses, he writes something that you can mull over for a long time. Six titles, six characteristics, six effects. Now, these six words he's going to use are concepts that are very closely related, and they reveal elements, aspects about the teachings of God. They all refer to the same truths, but each word holds a little bit of an unusual, distinct meaning of either the truth itself or its effect upon a person. So basically what we're going to read here, David said, look, here's an aspect of the law, here's what it looks like, and here's what it results in. We start in verse 7. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The law of the Lord, the word in Hebrew is Torah. That is the word that is used here. It means instruction, precept. It is from a verb. The Hebrew verb form means to teach. To teach. And it is used in reference to instruction or teaching regarding conduct. And the Torah, we call the first five books of the Bible the Torah. The instruction. It is applied to all of the teaching that God has given to mankind. It's not limited exclusively to just the commandments, but it includes all that God has revealed to teach us and guide us. So in a sense, he starts with the all-encompassing word, the law. The law of the Lord. Now, the characteristic, it's perfect. The law of the Lord is perfect. The word means it lacks nothing. There is nothing about it that would lead a human into error or into sin. There is nothing that is essential for humanity to know that cannot be found in the law. It's perfect. It's complete. That's a characteristic. The effect of it is it converts the soul. It changes your life. The law is perfect, converting the soul. It turns a person around. It puts your life in order. The law of God will put your life in order. Now, that's not implying that the law will do it all by itself. It means that when the law is applied to the heart, you see a sinner turning from the error of their ways and getting their lives in order. Here's the concept. The law of God is complete, and it will convert you. It will change you. The second, the testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. Now, testimony is not hard to figure out. We use that word all the time. It's bearing witness to something. You know, you have somebody who testifies. And here it means there is a testimony to which God bears witness, and God has given us witnesses. If you were to put humanity on trial, God could call a string of witnesses that would present an airtight case. God could parade witnesses all day long of those who have done poorly and those who have done well, but the testimony of the Lord is sure. Look at history. Look at people's lives. Look at your own life. And you see the testimony that when the law is followed, what it does, and when the law is broken, what it does. The testimony of God's word is consistent. And it testifies to the steadfastness of God's law. That's a characteristic, that it's sure. The effect, it makes the simple wise. It makes the simple wise. The word simple simply means inexperienced. In the sense, the simple person is the person who is either untaught or ignorant. And it refers to people who need spiritual guidance. So who are the simple? Every human. We are all born in our simplest state. And as time goes on, we hopefully realize that if we don't have God's truth in our minds, we are lacking something. We are in ignorance. And it will have an effect on us. We all lack wisdom. We all lack knowledge. But when you get the law and the testimonies of God, you begin to gain in wisdom. You begin to gain and collect a way of analyzing life and seeing the world that gives you a perspective that God calls wisdom. It's not just knowledge. It's not just understanding. It's understanding how it all works. It's understanding what to do. Verse 8, the statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. Statutes means the mandates, the precepts, the specific rules given to anybody to guide him. It says they are right. That word is the root of the word righteousness. We get righteousness from that. They are right. It can imply logical as well. They fit within the course of human life. They are also founded in principle. The statutes of God are not just arbitrary laws that some human makes up. Human laws change from time to time. You have one administration come in and they change the laws. Another administration comes in and they change it back another way. Humans are always tinkering with the laws, but the laws of God are righteous to begin with. They are logical to begin with. They are equal to everybody. They are just. They are proper. And what is the effect? They rejoice the heart. They make you happy. A lawful environment, you have happy people who live by those laws. Now, you'll note the progress so far. We went from law to testimony to statutes. And what are we seeing as the effect? Converted, made wise, made happy. Is that not a progress of life itself? When you become converted and you gain in the wisdom of God, you grow in happiness in the way that you live life. But it goes on. Second part of verse 8, the commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. Now, the idea conveyed, you might say, well, commandment, law, it's all the same thing, isn't it? Well, no, not exactly, because this says the commandment of the Lord. The idea in the original language in this phrase is that it carries the meaning of setting up, appointing, constituting, as one commentary said, hence, of charging or commanding. The idea here is not so much about the rightness of the thing itself, but the fact that it was ordered by God. It's God's commandment. God is the author of this, the commandment of the Lord. This is what He requires. It is pure. It is free from imperfection. It's free from stains. Nothing has ever dirtied God's law. The Hebrew means to clear or to cleanse or to purify. And the concept is all of what God tells us to do leads to a purity of life. What is the effect? It enlightens the eyes. It enlightens the eyes. You begin to see things. There's another psalm that says, a good understanding have those who keep His commandments. It doesn't say, keep the commandments once you have a good understanding. It says, keep the commandments, and you will get a good understanding. It's not just a set of rules. God is not out here just imposing rules on people. He's explaining to us how life works at its best. And once you get that, it enlightens the eyes. It gives light and knowledge. We see how to go. We see how to walk. We see where to go, what to avoid. Verse 9, the fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The fear, the awe, the reverence. Now, this particular topic has to do with not our law, not the law itself, but an attitude toward the law. Fear of the Lord has to do with the attitude toward the law giver. Knowing the commandment, knowing the law is not enough. There are lots of people who have known the law, but they had a bad attitude toward it. They did not fear God. That's a big subject in itself. But it has to do with the attitude, the awe, the respect, the reverence toward the law and the lawgiver. It is clean. This is closely related to the word pure in verse 8. But it means that its object is to make a spotless character. The fear of the Lord is what leads to a spotless, clean character. And it endures forever. It gives stability. It gives consistency. If we fear man, we will always be changing. Depending on who the person is, we have to fear at the time. If you fear God, you only have one to please. It gives you consistency. You won't be wavering. And finally, he says, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. The judgments of the Lord, the Hebrew word for true means to support, to confirm, to make stable, to make certain. And they are righteous altogether, without exception. There's nothing that is unjust or improper in God's judgments. Now that's just a brief look at it. If you really wanted to delve into these things, you would find more and more to think about. And obviously, David had thought about this a lot. He constructed this so beautifully. Six words, six characteristics, six effects. Who was David? Well, at this time, he was the head of a kingdom that was already powerful and wealthy, and it was on the rise. He was one who had everything at his disposal. Every human, he could command them to come and go. He had access to all the wealth. But what does he say about these six traits? In verse 10, he says, more to be desired are they than gold. Yes, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. Your servant, he said, who is that? Who would that be? Anybody who chooses to serve God. David was the king. He had servants. But he also put himself in perspective of the universe. And in that sense, he's one who wrote, who am I? When I look up into the heavens, what is man? He did not look around at the world and put himself in the context of humanity. He put himself in the context of being under God, a servant of God. And he said, these things, these are the things that are really of value. The law of God governed him as much as it governed the poorest person in his kingdom. And in that sense, the law of God is the great leveler of the playing field. Every human answers to God on an equal basis. He could not break the laws of God governing family or marriage or child rearing and expect his life to somehow escape the penalties just because he was the king. It doesn't matter the rank, the position, the state of life, whether you're high or whether you're low, whether you're rich or poor, the laws of God are constant. They direct every human in the right steps. And furthermore, he acknowledged that knowing them gives you a warning system. Knowing the laws of God, it's an early warning device. It tells you what to watch for because you begin to understand. Part of the wisdom that comes through life is learning that humanity's successes and failures depend on whether they're doing things right in so many different ways. And we learn what to watch for. We have daily lessons about the law of God just by watching people. We see it all the time, every day. We see the power of God's law throughout all aspects of creation, ranging from the universe all the way down to how the human mind works. How we let our mind work, the law of God is there. Now we come to the third section of this psalm. We started with God's laws that govern creation. Then we turned to his laws governing humans. But now David turns very introspective. He gets into some of the deepest elements of understanding and attitude and conversion and some basic principles of how we have to live our lives. I said earlier, this is my favorite psalm in the hymnal. My only complaint about this psalm is that it lacks a fourth verse. It lacks the verse that covers the rest of this chapter. And this is where the lesson of this psalm runs the deepest. He makes again here, as I said, this abrupt turn. In verse 12, he asks a question. Who can understand his errors? Who can understand his errors? Well, what's he talking about now? He went to talking about the sun and the universe, and now he's talking about the laws of God, and now all of a sudden he's asking, well, who can understand his errors? It's logical, though, to come to that question. The word errors comes from a verb which means to wander or to go astray, to do wrong, to transgress. Now here, what is he talking about? He's talking about wandering away from the law of God. The very thing he was describing, these six elements that are so beautiful. When we err, when we go away from it, there's something that we ought to understand. But the first thing he asks is, who can understand it? Now, this is really a rhetorical question. He's not expecting an answer. It's a question that has its own answer. And the answer is, nobody can understand it without God's help. Paul makes an interesting statement in Romans 8. The carnal mind is enmity against the law of God. It is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. Can't be, it says. Now, a lot of people look at that and say, well, that's a little extreme. No, it isn't. God has to help a human understand his law. Understand not only what it is, but why it is, how it works. We live lives where we often wander away from it. And we have to be able to understand that. Who can understand his errors? There are a lot of times we know what our errors are, but we don't understand them. Why are they errors? Have you ever asked yourself when you've wandered away from doing something the way God would have wanted you to do it, and you finally come to yourself and you ask yourself, why did I do that? I knew better than that. See, that's the important question. It's not what did I do, but why did I do it? Why did I do that? Why do I wander away? We can only understand that with God's help and revelation. So, if you ask yourself the question, why do I do that? What answer do you come up with? What is the answer that we come up with? The more one studies of the law of God in life, the more we see how all of our errors result from lawbreaking. From lawbreaking. Most people do not see the depth of that. Or what typically we do as human beings, we like to assign our problems to other people's errors. And sometimes we are affected by other people's errors, but the errors that we bring on ourselves in life so often come from breaking the law of God. That's why a great lesson here, and that's why David is leading to this. It is so important to understand life, to check ourselves, to monitor ourselves and our thinking as to the root cause of errors. In Psalm 51, David recorded that psalm after his 7 days of fasting and getting back in line with God after his adultery with Bathsheba, David knew he had broken the laws of adultery. He knew that. David's big question was why. David was, to put it in today's language, David was a church kid. He'd grown up in the church. He'd grown up with the laws of God. He'd been taught the commandments. He knew the commandment. His question was not one of, I got myself in trouble because I didn't know. That wasn't it. His big question was, why did I do this? Why did I do this? And he talks in that verse about, in that chapter, about trying to find out. Trying to find out deep inside the heart, what was wrong in the heart. I know what I did. My problem is, why did I do it? Why did I do this? And when you really study Psalm 51, you begin to see some of the answers. David said, you desire, in Psalm 51:6, you desire truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden part, you will make me know wisdom. In the hidden part, you will make me know wisdom. He says in verse 12, cleanse me from secret faults. Cleanse me from secret faults. Now, what is he saying here? The implication is not of things that we try to keep secret from other people, but things that are secret to ourselves. Things we don't even see. Like we just quoted in Psalm 51:6, in the hidden parts, you will make me to know wisdom. Things that I don't understand yet. Sins that come from not really being aware of our tendencies, our own errors, our own inclinations, but coming to have wisdom about this. The word secret here means that which is hidden and covered and concealed. There are things that every person has that they really don't see about themselves. But in the passage of time and life, God can show them to us. And that's where growth comes from. As God reveals things and we understand. We understand later as time goes on, as we see our faults in reasoning or our faults in understanding or maybe a tendency to rationalize or the things that lead to self-deceit. Those are times when we begin to understand life much better. Praying this kind of prayer. When David said, who can understand his faults? He was asking God, cleanse me. Cleanse me from secret faults. Praying this prayer is a recognition that sometimes we don't see things. And every human ought to recognize that. Just like we don't see things about the universe until suddenly one day somebody discovers it. Our world around us, we're always discovering new things about the physical world. Same principle in the spiritual world. We're always needing to be on a quest to understand new things about our own spiritual world. And when we go on that quest, God will help us that way. He will help us understand. Praying this prayer is a recognition of that. It's a prayer of willingness to be able to come to truth, no matter what we may discover. Because in the area of spiritual discovery, sometimes we discover things we don't like. But that's good. That's good, because that's when we have a chance then to change. In verse 13, he said, keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Presumptuous sins. Now this word is different, and it's a different meaning than secret faults. In the previous verse, he said, cleanse me from secret faults. Now he says, keep me back from presumptuous. The word literally means, in Hebrew, that which is boiling. That which is boiling. Figuratively, it means swelling or inflated or, when you come to the spiritual, proud or arrogant. The same Hebrew word is translated proud in numerous scriptures. These are the errors, the sins that come from self-confidence, from relying too much on one's own strength. It's not so much the meaning of, you know, keep me back from things that I see, that I know, that are obvious. It means help me to see the things that come from self-reliance, the sins that come from pride. This prayer is one of asking God, help me to have a proper distrust of myself so that I don't rely on my own power, my own understanding, my own thinking. If I want my life to be in order, then I need to align myself with God's laws, God's thinking, so that I can govern my life according to His way. And then in verse 14, he says, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight. Words of the mouth don't mean much if they don't match what is in the heart. And if the heart doesn't match what is in acceptable in God's sight, that won't mean anything either. So our heart, our words have to be genuine, have to be acceptable to God. It's a plea of David. It's a prayer. He ends this with a prayer to God. Basically, let my heart and my words align with you, with the way you govern life, with the laws that govern and put in order what is an orderly universe spiritually. And then he ends with something very interesting. He says, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. That's an interesting word to end with. Of all the descriptive words of God in the Bible, why did David choose the word redeemer here? I don't think it was accidental. The Hebrew means my kinsman. Under the Old Testament law, the kinsman, the nearest kinsman, had the right to redeem the inheritance. You remember the story of Ruth and Boaz? Boaz was the kinsman who had the right to redeem her. Why did David choose this word? I think he chose it to end this song because the last three verses carry a strong message of humility and repentance. We've already read those. 12, 13, and 14 have a deep sense of humility and recognizing there is error in life. When he said redeemer, I think David was recognizing that in the world of human nature, not in the world of God's created nature, but in the world of human nature, we are all out of sync with the law of God. And that's why humanity is in such a mess. There is another law at work, though. And that is a law where God says, to this man will I look, to him who is humble and contrite and trembles at my word. We have a promise from God of a redeemer. We have a promise that he will, upon repentance, cover our sins. We have a promise. And that promise is as good as a law of the universe. It's the way God works. He redeems us. We need and we depend on a Redeemer, and in God's plan of creation, He provided for that. It's one of the greatest laws of life. It's the way God holds the opportunity for eternal life together. And that is, He promises to redeem. He has provided for that. He makes it possible. God's promises carry the weight of law. We heard in the sermonette reference to the promise, I will be with you to the end. Can we rely on that? Yes, because that promise of God carries the weight of, just like you can rely on the law of gravity. It's God's word. It's the way God is. It's the way He functions. This is a brilliant and yet a very deep psalm to consider. But it's good for us to occasionally step out of our man-made world and look around and understand and remind ourselves that, you know, the laws of God govern everything in life. They govern every aspect of life. And just as it governs the billion bug highway of all these little things going on over our house, over our head, that'll now probably freak some of you out to think that they could, millions of those little black specks could fall down on you. It governs that little invisible world. It governs the vastness of the galaxies that we can't even comprehend. And it needs to govern the billions of little thoughts that go through our minds too as we live our lives. Because those thoughts lead to actions. There is an awe and there's a beauty that comes from looking at the law and understanding the law of God. And if we are in awe of the laws that govern creation, how much more should we be in awe of the creator of those laws? I hope maybe looking at this psalm today helps us not only understand a little bit more, but be more motivated to live in harmony with those laws.